Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost. Stand alongside me and assistant editor Lee Boyce. Today is pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, millions of retirees are getting less than £100 a week in state pensions. So Tanya explains why and gives us some tips on how to boost that figure. We also look at rip-off pension advice fees and whether retiring abroad could become a thing of the past for Brits, what with Brexit and COVID. Also today, Lee proposes we pick up one of the most niche hobbies I think I've ever heard, chasing savings rates. But would you switch your account to Alica, DF Capital or Smart Save? We ask whether fixed bonds are worth locking into and discuss the exodus from NS&I and license to spend, as 007 star Daniel Craig says his children won't be inheriting his rather sizable fortune. Should you save a nest egg for your kids or just enjoy the money yourself? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, I wanted to go to this story that you have on your website about a retired judge, David, because I think it's something that we don't really talk about enough, and it's pension fees. Now, when David hung up his robes earlier this year, being a judge, obviously, he knew exactly what he wanted to do with his smaller private pension that he held with Prudential. Now, the 71-year-old, he planned to dip into the 70 grand pot over the course of the year to pay off his mortgage without incurring any more income tax. But he got clobbered another way. So when it came to retiring, David found more than £2,000 was missing from his pension pot. Tanya, pick up the story, would you? And remind us what a drawdown account is.
Drawdown accounts are a way of investing your pension at retirement, which most people do now instead of buying an annuity because they regard it as better value. But you basically continue investing your pension and you draw down an income from it to fund your retirement. This was a story by our sister publication, Money Mail, who interviewed this judge who would almost inevitably have had a decent final salary pension, but he had also saved up a smaller pot of $70,000, which he wanted to do something specifically with, which was pay off his mortgage and take it gradually so that he didn't have to pay loads of income tax on it over a certain amount of years. He was with Prudential. They prefer people to get advice when they take a pot like this, and that is for good reason. It is very easy to make serious or even calamitous mistakes with your pension at retirement. And I assume that they are doing this as a safeguard to ensure that people stay with them, get some decent pointers on what they should be doing with their pot. David does appear from his story to have had a meeting with a financial advisor as a result. The Prudential say that they made him aware of the advice and the fees, but obviously not sufficiently to make him realise what the full impact of that was going to be.
So to get advice, he went with the Prudential. They charged him.
There seems to be been a misunderstanding about what the advice was for and how it was going to be charged. What he could have done is move his pension elsewhere. I mean, he could have moved it to another provider and said, well, you know, not got advice, but basically avoided this. But he could also have got his own independent financial advisor. I assume that Prudential would have accepted it if he had got proof that he had seen his own independent financial advisor or planner, which may well have been the best option for someone like this, who presumably had a big final salary pension scheme as well, because then they would have taken a look at his entire situation, gone into a great amount of debt with him and set something up for him. Obviously, that comes as a cost. It may well have been more than £2,000, but a lot of people
didn't think he needed it. He knew exactly what he wanted to do with this pot. You know, he obviously he's an intelligent man, he's a judge, and he thought, hang on a minute, I know exactly what I want to do with this. Why can't I just do it? Why do I have to speak to a financial advisor?
Well, pensions are very, very complicated. Obviously, he probably thought that, we didn't interview him, but he probably thought that he could handle this. But there was quite an interesting piece about a year ago, I think, from someone who works for the Bank of England, who said, hang on, this pension stuff is really super complicated, isn't it? That was the gist of it. And I think that people who are really high-flying professionals might think that they can handle pensions, but there's an awful lot of stuff that you don't know that you don't know when it comes to pensions. And there are all sorts of traps, particularly regarding tax, that you can fall into. And it is better to get financial advice. And if you don't get financial advice, the government has got a free service called PensionWise. They might not go into all the ins and outs of your personal situation, but they will give you broad guidelines as to what to do, what not to do, what the main traps are. It's not clear whether he consulted them, but that is always another option. And it's a good baseline for people who don't want to get advice. If you don't get advice, you should definitely go to PensionWise at least.
Don't get me wrong. When it comes to this, my first port of call would be like, really seriously consider getting financial advice before you do this. But just reading this story, and I imagine with a lot of people, the problem is not necessarily, and I correct me, Lee, if I'm wrong here, that any mistake was made on David's behalf here. He knew what he wanted. Where the issue comes in was being charged and not realizing how much he would be charged for and being able to move somewhere else where he wouldn't have had to face a charge, because £2,000, over £2,000 from a £70,000 pot is quite a lot of money. Lee?
It is a lot of money, Georgie. And I think actually the crux of this story is the fact that the fee is so high. It's 2.84%, which feels like a lot of money for what could have been a very short conversation with someone, especially if you then start working that out as an hourly wage of whoever it was that you were on the other line to, and then an ongoing charge of 0.6%. But, you know, Prudential hasn't, in theory, done anything wrong here. You know, the fees would have been outlined in paperwork somewhere. Whether the fees were revealed to him over the phone or before the conversation happened, I'm not privy to that and I'm not too sure. But I think what really will irk people is just that high fee and then that ongoing charge. And it's not a new problem. The FCA did some research not too long ago saying that the average advisor charges 2.4% for initial advice and then an ongoing charge from 0.8%. And that's people that move pension pots in this way. And one in four pension pots move to drawdown accounts is accessed without regulated advice. So there is quite a large chunk of people that don't take advice. And the thing is, if you don't take advice in this kind of scenario, yes, you might be saving on having that big chunky fee come out. But on the flip side of that, you are then responsible for all sorts of myriad of complications that can come with a private pension. I think, you know, it's really difficult because we're encouraged, obviously, to save for our future. We're encouraged to have private pension pots. I think what a lot of people probably don't realise in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s even, when they're coming up to retirement, is how fees might start to bite, especially when you've started to build up a bigger pot. You might not notice it so much, potentially, you know, if it's a smaller pot. But imagine 2.84% on £200,000. You know, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And most financial advisors would charge an initial fee to talk through your finances, depending on what area of your personal finances it is that you're looking to have. But it probably wouldn't be 2.84% of a certain pot. It would more likely be a flat fee. Yeah. And it would be a flat fee you're more likely to absorb or at least take note of, because if you're looking around for a financial advisor, you know, one of your first questions is likely to be, well, how much is this going to cost me to have financial advice? Whereas if you're going and doing this with your pension provider, you're probably not thinking about it so much. You know, like if you phone up a bank customer service, you're not expected to be charged because you're asking for some advice on the phone. I think people might be falling into that trap of, oh, you know, friendly person on the phone's giving me however, you know, an hour of their time on the phone, and maybe sign some paperwork and just not seen this fee. And again, I'm going to go back here and say Prudential have done nothing wrong here. This isn't an attack on Prudential. There'll be companies that have got similar charges and a similar way of putting this message out there. But I think it's just that high fee that will kind of irk people. And just that fact that, really, you know, the best advice, as Tanya says, is perhaps go to PensionWise first off, especially for a relatively smaller pot like that, because you don't want to be stung for a couple of grand. No. Especially if you feel like you know what you're doing, and this ex-judge, to me, sounds like he had a clear plan of what he wanted to do with the money. He didn't seem like just someone that had absolutely no clue about pensions or his finances whatsoever. I think he's just been kind of almost trapped a little bit by the small print. Or it might not even be small print. It might have been big print that he's just simply not looked at again, I'm not privy to know how many pages of paperwork would have come with this, but I can imagine it would be quite a hefty little booklet and all sorts of stuff with it. And it just goes to show the importance of looking through all this stuff, especially when we're talking about sizable amounts of money in any area of personal finance.
I appreciate, as Lee said, look, Peru haven't done anything wrong here. They charge, others charge. What is the justification for the high charges generally? And give us some figures of what a difference that can make on your pot.
Well, I think you'd have to ask a financial advisor to defend their fees. They charge different levels of fees, and you're a customer and you can shop around. If the range is between 1% and 3%, it's down to you as the shopper to find the right one. In terms of their worth, when there was a big shake-up eight or so years ago, the rules were tightened up on how much training financial advisors need to have. They take, you know, exam after exam after exam, and you can check their credentials when you sign up. You can ask them and you can double check it on the various websites that, you know, have accreditation. You wouldn't expect to, you know, go to a lawyer and pay 50 quid. So you know, if you're expecting a certain level of expertise, which comes with like looking at your in the best case scenario, looking at all of your finances, you give them all to them, and they go through them all and come up with a plan for you. When you actually think about it, that is quite a lot of work. Not anyone can do it. So that is what you're looking at when you're thinking about why they're charging what they do. In terms of the impact, okay, so there are some figures in this story. If you have £100 pot and you're taking, say, a 4% income from it a year, and you're looking at inflation maybe about 2%, returns of 4% and so on, and fund charges, you could potentially make that pot last for 28 years. That's the sort of the baseline. Now, if you are being charged 3%, say, an initial charge on your pot, and then 1% ongoing fee thereafter, that brings how long the pot will last down to 24 years and will take a £26,000 chunk out of your pot. Now, obviously, you may well do better with investment, and the whole idea of investing your pot is to grow it so that the income you're taking out, it does run down the pot gradually because you're spending it, but you've got a chance of replacing that money if your investments do it well. Now, as a comparison to that, a 1% initial fee and a 0.5% ongoing fee, we're talking taking £13,000 out and your pot lasting for 26 years. So still less, but you do get the benefit of the financial advice.
Lee, this isn't a one-off. And I don't want to specifically go on the judge, but I do think, is there enough awareness around this? What is the moral of this story? Ask lots of questions, research.
You're definitely going to want to do your research before you start potentially contacting where your pension pot is. And actually reading stories like this can help raise awareness and help make you make a decision as to what you're going to do with your retirement fund and whether or not you're happy to pay that kind of level of percentage ongoing and initial fee, and what you're getting for that. You want to know what you're getting for that. Mm. And at the end of the day, as Tanya says, you wouldn't pay £50 for a lawyer. And, you know, you want to get some financial advice that you know is going to be solid. You know the people have got the right credentials and you're happy to pay for it. We're not saying here, you know, you should be paying bargain basement fees because, you know, quite often you do pay for what you get. But I think it's just that that level just feels high. It doesn't feel like that has been good value in terms of, you know, potentially how much information our judge in this story has been given. And given the fact that he had a fairly clear plan, I think add that all up and it seems like a quite an unfair fee, in my opinion. But you could argue the case that, you know, if that investment, if that pot keeps on growing or they're giving good advice, you know, how much is good advice worth? You know, and it's really difficult.
More than what you'd get without it, I think. But then how do you work that one out? You can complain, can't you, Lee, to the financial ombudsman if you're not happy with what you think is.
Yeah, and as Tanya says, you know, there was a big sort of like overhaul about this sort of 8 or 9 years ago. And if you are unhappy, like the ex-judge is in this case, there's no harm in going down that route. You have to have quite a strong argument. The thing is, I think that this is quite a cast iron Prudential aren't in the wrong, because they would have outlined the charge somewhere in the material, and potentially it's been signed and all of that kind of thing. Again, it was a story in Money Mail. We don't have all the full ins and outs of that. But it is a good story to hear, because a lot of people, as you say, probably aren't too aware of pension fees. I reckon there's quite a lot of people that are more engaged with their pensions than ever before, especially when you start going potentially up the ladder, earning more money getting siphoned into your pension, and you start taking more, putting more attention into where it's invested, you know, seeing that pot grow, seeing the compound interest, all of that kind of thing. You know, it can get quite exciting. You know, okay, maybe that's just me, but it can get quite exciting. But that sting in the tail further down the line is worth knowing about, and it's worth preparing for it. I'm not going to say when you're in your 30s or 40s, but, you know, it's definitely worth considering as you're starting to reach retirement age. As an overall thing, I think when I get a bit older, I probably will pay for some independent financial advice to have a look at all of my finances. And, you know, how you find a good financial advisor. Well, you know, there's sort of comparison sites that you can go onto and have a look around and see if there's someone local, or, you know, see what qualifications they have, all of that kind of thing, and then what they can do for you. And, you know, more so than ever before, like a lot of areas of personal finance, it's a lot more transparent than it would have been 20 years ago, when you probably would have had a financial advisor was someone that was recommended to you by a family member, or recommended to you by a friend down the pub. You know, there's way more options for people now. And I think that's the moral of the story, George. You just be aware of fees that could eat into your retirement, and how to try and navigate around it, or at least pay a fair level.
All right, then, we're sticking with the pension theme and triple lock discussions to one side. More than 2 million Brits get less than £100 a week in state pension payments. Hang on a minute, you might think. The full flat rate state pension is £179.60 a week, you think, or around £9,300 a year, £137.60 a week for the old state pension. True, but these are, of course, full rates, and there are many reasons why people might not be entitled to the full rate. Thankfully, you've pulled together some tips to boost that weekly figure, ways that you can boost that weekly figure. Firstly, though, Tanya, what are some of the reasons why you wouldn't receive the full state pension amount?
The most basic reason is that you don't have enough qualifying years built up, either by paying national insurance while you're working, or with some of the replacement credits that are available for various different scenarios, the most obvious being caring responsibilities for children or for adults, receiving caring allowance, for instance. Another big reason is a sort of historical issue to do with contracting out. People and their entire schemes could contract out of paying national insurance towards the second state pension. The system used to be two-tier, it's now flat rate, but when it was two-tier, you could opt out of paying that second bit. That didn't mean that you weren't getting anything, doing anything at all with your pension. It just meant that the employer took responsibility for ensuring that that part of your pension was covered. So a lot of people, they write to our columnist Steve Webb every week saying, what is this contracting out thing, and you know, why am I not getting a full state pension after I've, you know, worked for 40, 50 years even? And it is invariably because their employer contracted them out, and they're getting the pension. It's just they're getting it through their employer's pension, but that doesn't feel as real to them as their weekly state pension. And so they have to get around the fact that they haven't lost out. It's just their employer is paying it.
So those are some of the reasons. Where are these figures come from with this article saying that about 2 million people are getting less than £100 a week? Because there's quite a lot of research.
Yes, the basic figures seem to have come from the latest DWP data release. Hargreaves Lansdown have analysed them to sort of drill down into them a bit more, and they have come up with some various tips to fill the gaps. Because if you are heading for a smaller state pension than the full amount, there are ways to drag it up, and they have gone into that in some depth.
So it's good to know there are things that you can do about it. So what can you do about it to boost that weekly figure, Tanya?
There is lots that you can do, thankfully, and what you do really depends on your situation. The starting point is to go to get a forecast. If you just put in state pension forecast into a search engine, the government one will come up at the top. Make sure it is the government one and see what you're heading for. It will give you the figure about what you're currently on course for at retirement, so you can see if it's the full rate or not. You can buy more years. It's about £800, I believe, for a year. You can fill gaps going back. It's probably not sensible to do that too early on. If you're, you know, in your 30s or even 40s, it might be a bit soon, because just by working, just by, you know, having a working life, you are paying national insurance that way. So you don't want to overshoot necessarily too much, because you're going to have to carry on paying national insurance even after you've got the qualifying years in. One of the things that, if you've had caring responsibilities, say if you have spent a few years at home with your children, and this goes for, you know, men as well as women who do this, you can look at whether your credits for that are absolutely up to date. There is a nasty pitfall with that. Well, there's a couple, actually. Well, you have to sign up for child benefit to get those credits. Now, some people make the mistake of putting the wrong partner down. So the partner who's going out to work and earning national insurance qualifying years anyway, you know, earns the credits, and the person that stays at home who really needs them doesn't.
I wonder what you meant by then, puts the wrong partner down.
Yeah, what? I know, the wrong partner. Yeah. No. You can sort that out. I think going back to 2008, it's a bit of hassle, but you can actually swap yourselves back over. So, you know, you can get the right person getting the right credits. One of the more difficult pitfalls, though, which we've campaigned on for quite a long time, is that the people who don't qualify for child benefit anymore, because it might be their partner earns over 50,000, a lot of people think, well, okay, I'm not going to register or apply for child benefit because I won't get it. And in a way, that's the most logical thing to do. Why would you apply for something that you don't get? Unfortunately, it's worth at least registering for child benefits, because if you don't, then you miss out on these incredibly valuable credits towards your state pension. The link is not obvious, which we have pointed out time and time again. And the sting in the tail is that if you discover this, sometimes many years on, it can be 6 or 7 years on now, you only get 3 months backdated in terms of credits. So you're potentially losing a huge, great chunk of your state pension. If anybody is in that position and hasn't registered for child benefit, or knows someone who might not have registered for child benefit, please let them know, because unfortunately, at the moment, unless the government relents, that is an irreversible problem.
All right then. Good advice, Tanya. Well done for that. We're not quite finished with pensions yet, because if having the finances, or not having the finances, hasn't scuppered your dreams of retiring abroad, could Brexit and COVID? Now, Spain remains our destination of choice, but many are apparently reconsidering their plans. And if you do decide to go, you do manage to get out there, how would it impact on your state pension? Lee, do you think that's it for Brits abroad?
No.
We find a way, as we always do.
No way, Georgie. No, people love to think about, you know, retiring out in the sunshine or somewhere like Spain, where, you know, depending on whereabouts you go in Spain, a couple of hours away from Britain, there's usually expat communities, and people are drawn in by, you know, potentially a cheaper cost of living, a slower pace of life, the sunshine, all of that kind of thing, and beaches. And I get the impression that there's still a large chunk of people that are dreaming of this kind of retirement. And yes, things like Brexit and the pandemic have probably given it a little bit less kind of allure than before. But this research by Canada Life It does. It kind of does say that, you know, that's what it's pointing to. You know, there has been a dip of people believing that this is a reality, you know, the dream of retiring abroad, it will be a reality. And actually, there was something like half of over 50s who are thinking about or planning about retiring abroad, are rethinking about where they're going to go because of Brexit. And that's slightly up on the survey before. And also the pandemic, of course, you know, yeah. it puts things.
Well, it's like New Zealand and Australia. I mean, can you even still get there?
Well, those slip down the list because, you know, especially in New Zealand, you can't get in or out, you know. Mm. So, of course, that's going to have slipped down the list. I'm sure there's a lot of people that would still love to move to New Zealand. Again, would offer a lovely way of life, I'm sure. But I think it's just put it into sharp focus, things like, you know, healthcare, family and friends. You know, a lot of people go and retire to somewhere like France or Italy or Spain, and yes, it's a short flight away, but it's not a short flight away, you know, in the pandemic, in which, you know, lots of flights of course were scuppered, and a lot of people potentially still haven't seen their family members from Britain that ever retired abroad, you know, because it's not the easiest thing. You know, so all of those things in play have kind of made people probably a little bit more wary, or warier than they would have been before, about retiring overseas. But it's not dead in the water, Georgie. There's still going to be people that are going to want to go and either buy a place out or rent a place. I think the best advice is to go out and rent somewhere, and probably rent somewhere for all seasons. And, you know, if you've plucked for a spot, to see how much you like the area, because it is a lot of upheaval.
You've only got 90 days, haven't you, before you have to apply for a different permit?
That's it. So yeah, and that's the red tape and the paperwork that's been sort of talked about in this research, you know. And do people really want it? The other thing, there are a lot of people, and I don't know, no percentage figure here, this is just a kind of observation, I think there's quite a few people that do go and retire overseas, and some people's retirement pots is literally their state pension, and they try and go out there and live off of their state pension. They might have a small pot of cash saved up, you know, to get out there and get set up initially, and then think that the cost of living is so cheap that, you know, they could potentially use their state pension. And a friend was actually telling me about this was quite recently, so just still in the pandemic, my friend, his uncle has moved to Thailand, he's relocated to Thailand, he's decided to retire out there. And I said, oh, you know, has he built up like a good pot of cash, and is he buying a home out there and all of that kind of thing? He was like, oh no, he's just going to be living off his state pension. And I was like, you know, does he know about the state pension, you know?
Yeah, but Lee, look, having lived in Thailand and currently in Spain, the cost of living is, I mean, in Thailand, completely different. I'm just thinking, I probably, as a teacher years ago, probably did only earn about 100 quid. I can't remember what it was, but it was about that. And I could cover everything incredibly comfortably out there. In Thailand, you could do it. I think, look, even though the cost of living out here in Spain is a lot lower, I agree with you. I think you would be ambitious if you thought that you could get by just on your state pension out here.
Yeah. Well, and also it might have ended up being quite bad timing because of all the triple lock chat. We don't know what's going to happen next month and potentially what state pension might go up by. But in Thailand, your state pension's frozen, you know, so it won't.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I was going to get Tanya to throw in and say, Tanya, what are the implications in terms of state pensions? And if you are abroad and you've managed to get out there, you want to get out there, you know, Thailand or Spain or New Zealand or anywhere.
Well, over time, it makes an absolutely huge difference if your state pension is not being uprated.
Why is it not being uprated? What's the reasoning behind that? What are the rules around state pension if you move abroad?
It's a historical anomaly, really, because the government has got reciprocal agreements on uprating with a whole load of countries, and then it's also got no agreement with another whole load of countries. And if it doesn't have an agreement, then it just won't uprate your state pension. It will remain at the point it was when you left. If you return, it will go back up, well, it will go return to the point where it really should be. But as long as you stay abroad in one of these countries, it will be frozen. Now, we use the example, I think, of someone who retired on a basic state pension in 2000, and it was 60-something pounds. it would have been then, and it would have stayed at that, whereas somebody who was retiring now would be on £137.60. That's a huge amount. Obviously, it depends on how long you live, and it depends on if you've got other sources of income, but you can really see how that would whittle away over a long time, and it will potentially get harder and harder over time as well. What you might think you could put up with at 65, 85 might look very different.
Okay, be that as it may, Canada Life, who did this research, have produced a checklist if you are thinking of heading abroad. Tanya, what's on it?
I think it's split between doing research about where you're going and really tying up your affairs quite thoroughly back in the UK. I mean, there's lots of things that you need to do here in terms of informing your council, informing your bank, getting your mail forward through the via the post office, all sorts of things, utility bills, sorting all that out. But I think you also really should go into, especially when it comes to looking after the things that you might not be needed straight away, but if you're retiring somewhere, you are definitely going to need to know about what kind of healthcare system they've got, what is your access to it going to be, because you don't want to necessarily be having to come back and scuttle back to the UK to use the NHS when you're potentially infirm and frail. So that is one of the very important things. Also, other countries have very different tax systems. You want to make absolutely certain you know what tax you owe in the UK. Also, work out how you're going to be taxed abroad. I mean, if you're on a frozen state pension and all of a sudden you're landed with loads of unexpected taxes, you can kind of see how that would be a problem.
Yeah, I was just going to add one last little point to this, Georgie, and actually it is a big point, and you did sort of touch on it, and about Brexit, is about, kind of how you do manage to move to somewhere like Spain. So as you say, every 90 days, you're going to need to have a visa or residency, and there's no visas in Spain that are targeted to retirees. So you have a couple of options. There's something called a golden visa, a non-lucrative visa, or claiming residency in Spain. So it does make things a whole lot more complicated. But I think the real crux of this Canada Life research is, despite that, people still believe that they can make it a reality. It's just whether, when they get to the point of making that reality a dream, if they can get that over the line. And it's the same for a lot of countries, obviously Europe wide, but there's lots of other requirements, and there has been for a long time, to move to a country like Australia, to move to a country like the United States. You don't just have a British passport and you can just pitch up wherever you want in the world, without any kind of visa, rent a place or buy a place and move there. It's not as simple as that. So, the number one tip for me that isn't in this Canada Life research, but Tanya rightly points out, it says research where it is that you think that you would like to retire to, and see if it's actually even a possibility. A lot of them require a certain level of savings, for example. Don't want you to be a drain on healthcare, for example. How are you going to afford that kind of thing? Yeah. There's lots of bits, to think about. I think the reality sometimes then hits home when you start going through one of these checklists and you think, this isn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. I thought I could just get an easy jet flight over the Spain and bish bash bosh, I'm living there. And then I think actually there's a lot of TV programs in Britain that are pitched that way. People just move away, and I think you need another hour episode to show us all of the red tape and all of the other considerations that are not on there. But that doesn't make good television.
No, it doesn't. Let us not scupper your dreams. I just worked out on a currency converter. I was earning, I can't be bothered to work out how much it was then, but it would be equivalent now of £447 a month. And getting by very comfortably. But bear in mind, I was young and in good health and had travel insurance to cover any problems I might have had. So yes, I do appreciate that would be very tight. But anyway, that's it. That's the end of part one. We'll be back shortly after this.
This podcast is sponsored by eToro. And as at This Is Money, we always like to help you learn more. We've got Sam North of eToro to answer a quick question for us. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Simon. Pleasure to be here today.
Okay, Sam, Today's question surrounds managing risk. Now, this is a concept that's often discussed in the investment world, but what does risk management in investing or trading terms mean?
Managing risk, effectively. We can never be 100% sure on the direction of investment. So it's important to identify, analyze, and accept that there is going to be some uncertainty. So for me, risk management is one of the most important aspects of being a smart investor and critical for long-term success. I mean, for example, never risk more than you are afraid to lose. Always do your research into what you are investing in. And, you know, I say to people, don't risk more than 2% of your account on a singular trade, for example. Decide where the trade no longer makes sense before you've even got into it as well. Be patient. Don't go chasing. You know, want to let the market come to you is all advice that I give to newer traders and investors. And we'll cover that in the webinar that we run. But yeah, risk management, self-awareness and discipline, the top three most important aspects of being a smart investor.
Okay, Sam, thank you very much. That's very, very sensible advice for people.
Welcome back. Now, Lee, of the boy who used to dream that one day he'd grow up to be an estate agent, has come up with a new hobby for us all. It's not fun. I'm sorry, Lee. It's not fun. But it's sensible. And this is a sensible podcast. Chasing savings rates. Woohoo! With deals from small challengers on the up, Lee, you say it's time to buckle up and go hunting. Look, you've even tried to make it as exciting as, but Lee, it's not going to work. Okay, so what happened to playing football or supporting South? At least supporting South End. That's not a hobby either. Baking banana bread, Lee.
Georgie, I've written this in a white knuckle ride of a way. This column goes a million miles an hour. I'm telling you, if you're not inspired to start making your savings work harder after reading that, well, there's just no hope for you. I'm not watching Southend at the moment, Georgie. We've gone non-league. Banana bread. Oh, I had enough of that last year. No more banana bread. We're on a banana bread ban. Instead, I'm chasing savings rates. That's what I'm doing with more of my spare time. There's a serious message behind this, because what's happened in the last couple of weeks is that savings rates have finally started sort of going up at a pace. For the first time really since the pandemic sort of made rates completely just fall off a cliff. I mean, they were already sort of halfway down the cliff, and then they sort of slipped underwater by the time the middle of the pandemic was here. What's happening, especially in the fixed rate stakes, is we're seeing a lot of smaller challenger banks sort of climb over each other to be the best buy. And it's quite important for these challengers to become the best buy, because the familiarity of that of their names isn't there. So you know, they don't have a big draw of some of the challenger banks that you might have heard of, or the high street banks or building societies. People are like, what's this? They have to work harder to encourage people to put money in them. And at the end of the day, in our independent This Is Money savings tables, all of the accounts that are mentioned in there are FSCS protected up to £85,000, and also they're just literally done by rate. No one pays money for it to be at the top of them or anything like that. So we are seeing rates really inch up. Now this week I thought it was quite interesting that we had Smart Save went to the top of the 1 year fixed rates, for example. Later on that day, Zopa overtook it and went to the top of the 1 year rate, and then Smart Save took the battle back and up the rate again and went to the top of the best buy. And that was all over the period of 1 day. Now that's exciting for me. That's exciting because we've had none of that. And it just means that rates have started to inch higher. Now 1.41% on a 1 year fix is actually fairly decent when you realize that, you know, we were slipping under 1% not so long ago. You know, that's an actual sizable, you know, rise. And even Easy Access, you know, it was stuck on 0.5% for a long time. We're now on 0.65%, and hopefully we'll keep seeing rates ticking higher. Now, the reason why I'm saying chasing rates is that there's no point of us being upset that rates are low if we've got money, billions of pounds, parked in legacy accounts paying 0.01% in banks. You know, that's great for them. They're loving it. You know, that's like the cheapest form of money they can have. They're loving having that big pile of cash. And, you know, collectively, it's all the people that have little fiddly pots and things that they just think, oh, you know, what's the point of moving all of that? And all I'm trying to say here is it's worth giving one of these challenges a go. It's worth just, you know, finding out what money you've got sitting around doing nothing, and just pulling money out as much as we can, you know, to get it working harder. And that's what all I'm trying to say in this, Georgie. And especially now, it's worth it because rates are going higher and cash ISAs as well. I update our 5 of the best cash ISA guide every couple of weeks, and rates have gone higher even in tax-free accounts. So it's all good little signs.
Lee, I appreciated the tone. I also appreciated the, I think it was a Twitter message from James Blower, the savings guru, about that day of excitement. It was like a horse race, and coming in through the front is Oberyn, it is overtaken by Tandem. It was a marvelous tweet. I mean, it got me excitedly. But there might be, forgive some people for sort of looking at things like Smart Save, DF Capital. I mean, Tandem was in their Zopa, we've probably heard of, I think, vast majority of us. But you know, things like Alica, not Alicia, by the way, all these places to put your money, is obviously it's safe, you've just said it's safe, but you know, some people might be unconvinced, shall I put it that way?
And they should
Who
be
are
and
again, they?
And again, I should point out in this column, before you are tempted to move your money across to one of these, you know, do your research, you know, find out what kind of level of customer service that they're going to be offering. You know, I would even go as far as giving the customer service phone line a quick call just to see how quickly they pick up, for example. Just one little tip, having a look round at reviews, you know, is it going to be easy for you to access your money and all of those kind of things? You know, there's some due diligence to go through, not much, but there should be a little bit, and just make sure that the money is FSCS protected. You know, that is the crucial one, because we wouldn't recommend any kind of savings account that isn't in there. Basically, we had someone write in asking the very question, you know, can I trust these banks? Who are they? What do they do? I actually think that the large majority of people wouldn't have heard of them. I think because we are kind of in the industry, we kind of know some of them. So Tandem, I'm familiar with. And basically, it has a banking license where it took over Harrods Bank in August 2017. And that's offering the best easy access at the moment of 0.65%. And that, what it does with the money. So it's also important to know what they're doing with the money that you're putting in. I always think it's important to know what it's, you know, what is its actual business model? What you pay your savings in, where's that money going? What's being done with it? Right. So for Tandem, it funds green initiatives to help make UK homes more sustainable and environmentally friendly. So that's got a kind of bit of green credentials in there if you like that kind of thing. Smart Save is based in Wrexham. It's part of the Chirpwood Financial Group. Now, money that's put in there, they've got some of the best fixed rates at the moment. It's basically, they've got two other arms, which is called Live Lend and Better Borrow, which are basically personal loans. So your money's been lent out in form of personal loans. Alica Bank, I'll confess, I hadn't heard of Alica Bank, to be honest, at all. So it's always good, even, you know, learning these things as you go along. And I've been covering savings, this is money, you know, since 2010. So I was like, who are these guys that have popped up? But they've had their banking license since September 2019. And they've got offices in Milton Keynes and London. And they do small business. That's what the money is there. And DF Capital, again, not one that I'd heard of. It was founded in 2016. It's based in Manchester. And it does niche commercial lending, helping small and medium-sized businesses across the UK. It was actually only authorised as a bank in September 2020, which is probably why I hadn't heard of it, given that there was, you know, stuff going on. Stuff that made me not really sort of take notice of new challenger banks that had been authorised and given banking licences by the FCA. But it is a long process, starting up a bank. There's all sorts of capital requirements. There's all manner of hoops to jump, rightly so, to make sure that the quality of the business is there. And for those reasons, I think that, you know, these savings providers are worth giving a go if you've done your due diligence and checked how your, you know, easy it is to contact them, for example. So there's little chinks of light. Hopefully there'll be some more challenges and a few more building societies that will pop up, and we'll see rates heading a bit higher. Yes, you know, they don't beat inflation at the moment, you know, these rates, and I know that, I'm fully aware of that. I don't set the rates, don't get cross with me.
Your fault, Lee.
All I can report and all I can say is that rates are nudging higher, and hopefully they will continue to nudge higher.
Well, Lee, you mentioned fixed rates, just briefly on this one, the fixed rate fixed rate bond frenzy. I'm loving this language. It's great. Rates are up to 1.35% for 1 year. So, I mean, yeah, it's not hitting inflation, but that's still double what you could get just a few months ago in April, I think, when rates were at rock bottom. So is it worth locking in, Lee?
That's old news, Georgie. That 1.35% is now 1.41% in the Wednesday that went to print. That's what I'm saying. Where's it going to be this time next week? I don't know. God, we could be talking about 1.45%. I don't know. The sky's the limit.
Good job you didn't lock in at that 1.35 then, isn't it?
Well, to be honest with you, it all depends on your circumstances. And again, pointing back to that column, it is important to have an everyday sort of savings fund, something that you can dip into if you need it. And having a kind of bread and butter easy access account is probably the staple that most people would use for that. And the reason why I say it's important to have a bread and butter account is that if you have an emergency, if you do have investments, for example, you don't want to start tapping into your investments to get the money out. You don't want to start having to put money in your, you know, some people like to do it in their current account. And I think unless you've got a secondary current account and that's earning a bit of interest, it's quite pointless, because otherwise it just gets absorbed by everyday spending. It's very hard to keep it separate. Yes, we live in an age in which, you know, people have banking apps and you might be able to separate the pot out, but if it's not earning any interest, I don't really see the point. Yes, okay, you've got it and you can see it with your own eyes without having to log in somewhere else, but it's quite important to have this bread and butter account. Now, if you're going to fix, you want to make sure, obviously, that you're going to not need that cash within the next 12 months. But 12 months goes pretty quick. And the reward for fixing for 12 months as opposed to having an easy access account is earning more than double interest than you would on an easy access. But, you know, you have to be aware of the pitfalls. I mean, personally speaking, I think it's good to have a bit of money rolling over in a fixed account. So let's say you've got a 1 year fix, you put some money in there, you've got an easy access account and you're putting some money in there. What I like to do is after a year, take that easy access money, take that 1 year bond, reinvest into 1 year bond and restart the process for the easy access account. That's what I do. And that just, you know, helps keeping that little pot ticking over. I'm not talking about huge sums of money here, because, you know, the huge sums of money go either into my private pension or they go into my investments. But it is still important just to have that little safety net. Personally speaking, I think it's important. And we laugh and joke all about the rates and me getting excited by it. But you've got to understand, we've had a barren few years in terms of challenger banks, any kind of bank, any kind of building society, igniting any kind of savings battle whatsoever. I'm going to milk it for every penny, Georgie.
And you do that, Lee. I won't ruin your fun there. Tanya, I just want to touch on NS&I. Savers withdrawing about $13 billion from their products in the first quarter of this year. That's twice as much as last year. Why? And have we fallen out of love with things like premium bonds? Could it be?
Well, they slashed the rates to practically nothing. And so obviously people took their money out in droves. Unfortunately, they also had a big customer service meltdown at the same time. So people who were trying to get their money out probably had like a bad experience, some of them. And if I'd gone through that, I might be disinclined to go back when they put the rates up, because that kind of thing sticks in the memory. When it comes to premium bonds, I think that the prize element is always going to attract people. The people who are into premium bonds are just into them. And the people who are not in them but are likely to be tempted by that kind of scenario, they're always going to be tempted. I think that the prospect of winning a big prize means that people don't look at the rate so much as they would maybe on the ordinary savings products that NS&I has.
Right, well, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.